Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. We're back with our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond. Joining us today are Dr. Gordon Adams of the Quincy Institute Think Tank, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who, among his many hats, is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
Always a pleasure.
Good to be back.
Thank you.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our strategy coverage. And Beretta USA is sponsoring our coverage of the virtual AUSA annual meeting, AUSA Now, as well as our land warfare coverage. Everybody, thanks very much again for joining us. I mean, it's certainly been an action-packed week. It's hard to tell exactly where we are. Unfortunately, more than 212,000 Americans have lost their lives to COVID. Obviously, the President of the United States has been infected. The Joint Chiefs of Staff are quarantining. Two senior military leaders, the Vice Commandants of the Coast Guard and the Marine Corps have the virus. Plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan. Pretty extraordinary news on any given week. President suggesting that Gold Star families infected him. And of course, there was a vice presidential debate. And sadly, it's remembered for a fly and some of the negative comments that the president made about what is a historic vice presidential candidate at a personal level. If you want to attack her policies, that may be a different thing, but it became a very personal and vitriolic attack. And on top of all of that, the president of the United States suspended negotiations that were ongoing between Speaker Pelosi and Secretary Mnuchin, and evidently based on folks was making progress for a fourth stimulus package that we have been discussing quite literally until since March, as best as I can tell. Michael, I know that it's Groundhog Week or Blur's Day when I ask you this question every week. Where are we? What's likely to happen next? And what are sort of the defense implications of where we find ourselves right now? Because the president called off negotiations, then he said he wanted airlines bailed out, and then that got back pressure, and then he sort of semi-expanded it, but it's nowhere where Democrats want this to be. And in fact, it's probably nowhere where Republicans ultimately politically feel that they have to be. So where are we in this process as talks sort of resume?
Well, I think Mitch McConnell put it best yesterday when he said the discussion from day to day can be confusing for all of us to follow. So I will do my best. So let's go back to where we left off last week. Yeah, I think we agreed that negotiations over a new relief package were already on life support. So on Tuesday, the president pulled the plug and walked away from the table on negotiations. But this was just days after he had tweeted and urged Congress to get a package done. And it was on the same day where the Federal Reserve chairman was literally pleading with lawmakers to get another package done because he said there would be dire consequences to the economy if we don't pass another package. But later that night, Trump called on Congress to pass a standalone relief bill for airlines, small businesses, and again for stimulus checks to individuals, which led Pelosi to publicly question whether Trump's medication was playing a role in his thinking. And as you know, later today, she's going to hold a press conference on the 25th Amendment. That really started to lead people to worry that there would be no package. It was a huge gamble for the Republicans. And, if Trump were to lose and Republicans did not hold on to the House and the Senate, the fear was not only wouldn't there be anything done in the lame duck session since Trump wouldn't have any incentive, but nothing would get done until the following year. So that takes us to Wednesday, where, Pelosi had dismissed Trump's call for the piecemeal approach, but the speaker was very open to the idea of providing airline relief, especially since the industry had announced layoffs of up to 50,000 people. So Pelosi and Mnuchin continued their discussions this week, but she did remind Mnuchin that the Republicans had blocked an airline relief package earlier this month. So the idea was really being taken seriously by Pelosi and her conference. But then on Thursday, Pelosi announced that she would not support a standalone bill for airlines unless there was a commitment for a larger package, which would include the things that she's been pushing, you know, extended unemployment compensation, vaccine research, help for schools. So she wanted the two tied together. So that seemed to be a bit of a change in course. That afternoon, the White House reaffirmed its support for the skinny package. And then Trump then last night, spooked by the markets, called Kevin McCarthy and said now he wants the big deal. So, you know, there seems to be interest still, but, you know, we're 25 days away from the election. The House is out, although it could be called back. It would take at least 5 days to put legislation together. The Senate is out until October 19th because of a COVID outbreak among senators. And when they do get back, they're going to be scurrying to work to confirm a Supreme Court nominee. You know, and there's also a reason why a deal has been hard to get, because there are still major differences over a price tag and major differences on the policy side. So with 25 days left to go, I'm still very skeptical.
Mackenzie, you know, how are you seeing all of this? And if I can get Dove and Gordon as well to weigh in about sort of where we find ourselves, you know, briefly, just let's walk across the line.
Sure. I mean, the common theme here is pandemonium leading up to the election. It's a busy October, but you know, the arrows are pointing in every direction. So the president's all over the place on the stimulus, as Michael just aptly outlined. He's all over the place on the next two presidential debates. Will they, won't they? Maybe we will, not virtual, maybe we won't. He's all over the place on the Afghanistan drawdown, tweeting, you know, everybody, all American troops will be out by the end of the year. And Pentagon leaders and others have said, wait, actually, what, you know, as you mentioned, Vago, the Joint Chiefs are mostly in quarantine and Secretary Esper is continuously on travel. So it's just a very hectic time and there really is no clear leadership, no singular voice. It's clear that this White House does not sort of have a song sheet from which everyone sings from the same tune to the same tune. So it's just, I think everyone's just running in place until November and it's going to continue to be this way. The irony of Michael's comments on the stimulus is that there's a deep desire on both sides to pass a bill. If they could just come up with anything, I don't even think the number much matters. The rank and file of both parties in both chambers defer to their leaders in the White House and in the two parties and in the two chambers to decide what's best to put in that stimulus. For the most part, if they could agree on something, you know, the Mnuchins and Pelosi's of the world and Meadows, Congress would overwhelmingly vote for it now or whenever.
It really is extraordinary. And I mean, in the midst of all of this literal abject chaos or a crap show, as some people would refer to it, there's, you know, the president claims that he's feeling well and he's feeling better, although he's not released the kind of information that I think most people would like to see of a president who is afflicted with a very, very bad virus. And again, not to compare this to Herman Cain, but Herman Cain was feeling better and saying, I'm out of the woods and I feel great. And then shortly after that ended up passing away, sadly, of coronavirus, right? I mean, so there's that degree of uncertainty that hovers over all of this as well. And I find it interesting that anybody is surprised. We've been living through this lack of a song sheet for 4 years, and it's the pace of chaos has only increased over time. Gordon and Dove, want to get your quick sense on this financial and budgetary implication question. And then I have sort of a broader strategic question that I want to put to all of you as well.
Well, we're just treading water in budgetary land. What's surprising about this is we've gone from two October surprises in the last week and a half, the president's COVID diagnosis and the Whitmer kidnap plot in the state of Michigan, neither of which could he expect. And frankly, in the next 25 days or whatever it is, I expect more October surprises. We're going to be riddled with October surprises. As Michael is saying, basically, the budgetary thing is sort of turning on the point of a knife at this point. The one piece I think he didn't mention, Michael, was the state and local government assistance, and that has political implications as well, because assistance that is driven by the Democrats for state and local governments is going to be used, as everything else is, as a political stick to beat the other side with. So we've got a kind of a grab bag going. You know, it's one of those bags that you buy that you don't know what's in it, and you pay $10 for it, and you'll be surprised when you pull it out over the next 3 weeks. Don't see where this is going. That said, from the point of view of the Department of Defense, I think the biggest issue for them right now is not budgetary, because whenever that comes for this year, and it's pretty well fixed. It's not putting the defense budget in doubt. What the real challenge for the military is right now is that we kind of have a headless administration. It's not clear what policy is going to be in any direction over the next 3 weeks. We're pretty much operating in a policy-free zone. And the military, with most of the senior leadership now in quarantine because of COVID infections, are going to have to look fairly carefully. I did a piece for The Conversation this week. It was pretty nearly picked up across the country, that basically is saying that everybody in the bureaucratic level, the deep state, if you want, is in a position in place to execute, to do what needs to be done to maintain U.S. diplomatic relations, U.S. military policy, contingency planning, etc. But right now, it's very hard to know where to turn with no clear direction coming from the top.
Well, let me pick on that a little bit, because the next question that I wanted to introduce and maybe get your take on it, and then Dove, and then go back down the line as well, if it's all right. Right, the United States is in a period of extraordinary chaos. The president of the United States is sick. Much of the senior White House staff is sick. The Joint Chiefs are quarantined. The level of distraction with the president's illness and COVID and a political race is such that the United States, aside from Mark Esper being outside of Washington, the United States has not been involved nor has been factoring prominently in the Armenia-Azerbaijan challenge, right? Talks are now happening in Moscow. Obviously, that's a Russian sphere of influence, but normally the United States would get involved somehow or lead an international response or somehow be connected with talks. We've not seen any of that. If you look at it, China recently announced that it would participate in a global vaccine program in which, you know, to try to get as much vaccines around the world. You know, you could look at this as a clean win. The United States doesn't want to participate in that, accusing China of COVID. COVID may have started in China. At this point, it's very, very hard to say that China is to blame for the fact that 212,000 Americans are dead. We're making a whole series of decisions, in part fueled by the White House, and people aren't wearing masks. They're not social distancing and they want to get out, as opposed to actually properly locking down nationwide for maybe a month to mitigate the economic impacts, right? That would have been severe and very brief and a V-shaped recovery. It's because people still don't want to wear masks and still don't want to isolate and still don't want to practice social distancing under the guise of individual freedom that we're likely to be living this for maybe another year, right? And that's going to be a worse economic impact. What does this say for America as a superpower, America's role in the world? And does this pretty much ensure that China is going to get up to no good, just like Turkey is getting up to no good, right, because of its extraordinary indirect involvement in the Azerbaijan-Armenia conflict? Is this just going to empower people? Is this what's going to ensure that the period between now and January or February, when this is decided, are going to be the most dangerous coming months and further weaken America's role as a global power? Sorry for the long question, but it...
That's a long question, but, you know,
I don't think... Kidnapping plots thrown in there as well. I mean, it's just...
I don't think that we have anything here that is new. Okay, what we have basically is the last 3.5 years on steroids. You didn't mention, for example, the mixed signals about Afghan withdrawal, systematically undermining Zal Khalilzad in any effort to negotiate with the Taliban. You know, every single piece of American foreign policy has been up for grabs for the last 3.5 years. And we have that now in a kind of a rush, an electoral frenzy, spinning into the next 3 weeks and probably in the next 3 months. And it only reinforces the trend, which I've been talking about with us for the last 3 years, basically, which is the United States is not a superpower. Oh, you might measure its military as superpower capable, but it is not acting as a superpower. It has not been a superpower, both because of the nature of this administration and because power shifts in the world are basically saying the Americans are not needed. I'm not in the least surprised that we don't have any statement or policy or role in the Nagorno-Karabakh dispute. That really is being handled on a regional level. I'm not saying made peaceful, just being handled on a regional level. So we're seeing some centrifugal forces in the global system and the regional systems that have been underway for a while, totally accelerated by the actions of this administration. And it's going to be a very hard challenge if Joe Biden is actually elected president, and we may not know until January, to reestablish any sense of orderly process with friends and allies around the world. So, yes, I think we're looking forward to chaos. Yes, I think it frustrates military planning. It frustrates diplomatic strategy. And I don't expect it to settle. And it is scaring the bejesus out of most of the allies of the United States around the world who have already, over the last 3.5 years, begun to pull back and do things on their own. That, of course, includes China. And when you say, Vogel, up to no good, or the Russians up to no good, do not assume because the Chinese are stepping into the breach in certain international organizations that that is no good. It is not necessarily a nefarious act, but the Chinese are very good at exploiting these openings to assert their own role in the international system. And they've been doing that for several years, and they are still doing that. And that's going to raise huge challenges for the way the next president, Joe Biden, perhaps, in terms of how they craft the relationship with China. We have no clear direction on that. As usual, China's being thrown around as a political cudgel in a presidential campaign, not for the first time. It's not at all clear from the cudgel war in the campaign how China policy is going to be developed. But if we start from the perspective of China is always up to no good, we're not going to have a very good relationship with China going forward.
And to clarify, my point of China not being up to no good is the specific and very targeted ratcheting up of tensions with Taiwan is what I'm talking about. I think that China can play a very, very positive and important global role as a great power, including, participating in virus programs. What I'm talking about no good is, you know, it succeeded in crushing Hong Kong, which was okay. It's even in violation of the agreement it signed, but it is acting very, very badly across the region and specifically toward Taiwan. Let me let Dove in because he's been patiently waiting as you got two turns. Dove, start us off because I know you, like Gordon, have a lot of experience in this and talk to people around the world on a very regular basis.
I don't have anything that I disagree with that's been set up to now. Let me add a few things. First, if you're sitting in Berlin, London, Paris, Moscow, Beijing, and you see the Speaker of the House saying that we really need to think about the 25th Amendment because there's something wrong with this president, that's not just a domestic matter. Those folks out there, friends, allies, adversaries, they're all wondering, you know, is there something really wrong with the president? Do we have a Woodrow Wilson situation? As you know, Wilson had a stroke and his wife ran the country. That is a major problem for us that, frankly, what Gordon was talking about in terms of some degree of progression where we're clearly not the same superpower we are a superpower, but we're not what we were, no question. This is something completely different. So that's problem number one. The problem number two is it's not just the leadership of the Pentagon that's not well and the Secretary of Defense making a point of being out of the country the way Don Rumsfeld once did when he was ambassador to NATO to get away from Nixon administration. You know, there were people sitting around the, not just around the table, but with against the wall in the conference room, and they may have been spreading stuff. And in the Pentagon right now, one of the problems, the Pentagon, I think, just changed their rules, but people were walking in the halls with their masks on. And when they went into the rabbit warrens, which are most Pentagon offices, the masks came off. So there's a problem there. How many people are really sick in the Department of Defense? We just don't know. And I'm talking about the headquarters. The next problem is that the bureaucracy always hunkers down around election time, waiting to see who's going to be the next president. they're doubling down this time. Again, because of all we've just talked about, confusion. Are we going to keep 2,500 troops in Afghanistan? Are we getting out before Christmas? You don't know from hour to hour what this president's going to say. It's back to that 25th Amendment problem. So that's another issue. And finally, whatever you might say about China getting involved in international organizations, that's probably a good thing, not a bad thing. How do you know they're not going to fire some missiles at Kimoi and Matsu? How do you know that Turkey will not limit itself to simply intervening in Nagorno-Karabakh, but will harass more gas, do more of the harassing it's already done of gas drilling in the Eastern Mediterranean? How do you know North Korea is not going to launch another missile or maybe even test a nuclear weapon? We just don't know. And when you've got a president who not only, by the way, is seemingly a subject of Speaker of the House questioning his mental processes, but who's come out and said that, well, we really ought to indict the man who's running against me, which sure sounds like Belarus rather than the U.S., we have a very, very serious problem, not just domestically, but in terms of how the world is looking at us.
Certainly an extraordinary investment on Vladimir Putin's part, because this is the kind of exact kind of disruption and chaos that he can point to, and actually she can point to, as both of these nations try to make the case, look how messy and disruptive democracy is. You can rely on us. You know exactly where we come from, and we are stable. These other guys are very unstable.
And by the way, the last person who's going to try to do anything aggressive is Putin, because Putin wants Trump reelected.
Well, sadly, and we've seen evidence of that. And obviously, national intelligence leaders have made that very, very clear. Mackenzie, let me bring you in, and then Michael, bring you in as well, especially if you can give us the political flavor up on the Hill. But Mackenzie, why don't you take this away, as you too are a strategist and are talking to folks about what are the implications of this. And I know that the AEI team also spends quite a lot of time looking at all of these issues.
Well, I think there's great concern across the board, as Dove and Gordon outlined pretty well. You know, it was manifest in the vice presidential candidate debate, where they both candidates struggled to articulate, you know, a vision for America's role in the world. What's our leadership responsibilities? Do we want to continue as our participation in many global organizations is fraying by choice? Nonetheless, you know, and in the absence of our leadership, as history will show us every time, you know, the vacuum will be filled. So there's a lot of concern that, you know, why was this a difficult question for either candidate? And, you know, they gave good answers on sort of detailed issues, you know, tactical strikes and operational questions, but not the big picture. What's really interesting, though, on the Hill this week is the talk is, you know, as I had said earlier, the rank and file are going to let the leaders duke out the stimulus, and they'll be ready to vote when it comes time. But the rank and file are all abuzz about the Esper speech on the Navy and, you know, this significant shift. It's not just, you know, the size of the fleet, but it's that he wants to give the Navy more money as a service. That's something navalists have been pushing for, as Chris knows well, for years and years. And, you know, it's kind of breaking defense tradition to upend what people call the golden ratio. I've published many times that that's actually not how the money is distributed. It's not roughly equal, one third, one third, one third. But nonetheless, the perception persists, and here we are. Either way, as Secretary Esper's remarks are significant, and members of Congress are scrambling in the House and the Senate to find a way to pay for the Columbia class without destroying the Navy, basically, meaning all the other priorities of Navy shipbuilding, as well as manning and maintenance and training and more sailors for all these ships if that's what's required. And that's really where members are this week. And I think that kind of should tell you that the big questions for the new administration, regardless of which party, it's going to be all about nuclear modernization in the early days.
And I want to point out, and we're going to talk about that 500 ship proposal that Dr. Esper put out. But, you know, there are unfortunate rumors that are going around not to want to feed them, but I mean, a couple of people and I have discussed it over the last week or so, and we've discussed this among ourselves as we prepared for this, the unfortunate possibility that the White House after the election may decide to make a change in leadership at the Pentagon, you know, perhaps by asking Secretary Esper to resign, which would send the ultimate worst signal at a time like that, given that he is doing his very, very best to you know, keep the Pentagon on the rails. Michael, can you give us your sense on all of this and how members are reacting to all of this in private, given how much time you spend with them?
Well, I'll just add one point. I think Mackenzie raised a really good point when it came to the Navy and what's happening on the Hill and some of the history there as far as how funding is allocated. You know, and I think your point is well taken that, you know, who will the next Secretary of Defense be and how long does Esper really have, whether Trump wins or loses. But, you know, I worked in the Pentagon during the first Gulf War. So I was there for the drawdown and the creation of the base force. And, you know, the Army at the time was cut by a third because the threat of the Russians coming through the fold the gap on 2 weeks' notice had dramatically reduced. But the Navy was only cut by a fifth, because we still needed the ability to project force rapidly around the world. And I think what Esper is laying out is a vision for a U.S. military in the United States that still is globally engaged. And that's really a question for who the next president is, because there's really a question as to how globally engaged Trump really wants to be.
And there is this sense that the Navy may actually fare better under a Democratic administration that may be somewhat less inclined to send troops aboard and may want to do more naval diplomacy. Dov, why don't we go into this? And Michael, stand by, because I do have a broader political question I want to ask you. But, you know, Dov, you've been working on these issues for 4.5 decades as a senior advisor to very, very many chiefs of naval operations on their executive panels, as well as directly. What's your sense on all of this? Because I think on the one hand, people are saying, hey, this is a great plan. But the B part of it is why now, right? Why 1 month, you know, away from the election? This is very, very reminiscent of Ray Mabus, in fact, right? Announcing his 350, you know, that the Navy has validated 355 ship requirement on his way out the door, which did become the Trump administration number ultimately as well. What do you make of the plan? How do we pay for it? Is there traction up on the Hill to deliver what would be such a dramatic increase in?
Well, first of all, this is not just a last minute thing. If you recall, the Navy had a plan. The Secretary turned it over to his own office, the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He then turned to the Hudson Institute think tank to put an entirely new plan for the Navy together. And that's what he's now working off. CAPE, the Office of Analysis and Evaluation, worked with the Hudson Institute, put together three alternatives. Obviously, the middle one is the one that you always choose. And then Esper makes his announcement. Now, there are more than a couple of issues involved. And you've already hinted at some of them, as has Mackenzie. One of them is, how many aircraft carriers are we talking about? The Secretary said we're going to go down to 8. 8 has been the favorite number of the Analysis and Evaluation Office for about 40 years.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so there's nothing new there. And Congress knows that. And if I'm not mistaken, and Mike or Mackenzie can correct me, there's actually legislation that talks about 11 carriers.
Right.
So there's going to be big time pushback on that one right there. Problem number one. Problem number two is, how do you operate this much larger force? We've had trouble finding enough money to operate and maintain the Navy. That's a lot smaller. That's less than 300 ships. And now we're talking about 500 or 550 and all kinds of new ships, unmanned ships, 70 perhaps of those. Where's the money going to come for that? And how are you going to maintain them and operate them? Well, as you said, the money could well come from the Army. the Army apparently believes it's going to come from the Army, but that's not a done deal either. So you've got a whole bunch of issues. We still have to figure out how do we work our allies into this. We don't have enough capability to cover not just the places we've always covered. What about the Arctic? The Arctic right. is opening up. If you're talking about the next 20 or 30 years, which is what navies tend to look at because that's how long they operate their ships, well, in 20 or 30 years, you're going to have a Northwest Passage. You've got the Chinese already up there. The Russians have always been up there. We can't do that ourselves. How do we work with allies? That has not yet been worked out entirely. And finally, what Mark Esper talked about did not work in how the Marines are going to work with the Navy. The Marines have indicated, General Berger's indicated how he wants to work with the Navy. But the flip side of that is, how does the Navy work with the Marine Corps? Lots and lots of questions, not many answers. And final point, I think you're right, Vago. If the Democrats come in, this plan is much more likely to take place. If it's somebody like Michelle Flournoy, she's out in the open about this. But in any event, remember, the Democrats are the ones who really got burnt in Libya. They're not going to be in the business of intervening anytime soon. In that respect, they and Trump are probably on the same page. But concern about China, concern about the Arctic, concern about the Eastern Mediterranean. Yeah, I think the Democrats are going to go much more in this direction than possibly the Republicans would.
I am going to go to Gordon because Gordon has been very, very patient. And then, Mackenzie, I want your take. I know that you're very, very short fused, but Gordon, give us your sense and then want to get Mackenzie's before she has to leave the conversation. Go ahead.
Well, my examination of what Esper's talking about here basically comes down to budget, budget, budget. I think they're living in a dream world in terms of the money and the projected costs of this thing. One of the most often honored traditions in the breach of talking about defense spending is to assume in your out-year budgets that operations and support costs are going to at least remain stable, if not go down, and that the next generation of equipment is going to be cheaper to operate and sustain than the past generation of equipment. It is a rule systematically violated by virtually every generation of hardware that we've brought in for the last 70 years. That makes it a dream world all in and of itself. But add to that, that if you look at the numbers projected out here in terms of the procurement budgets forecast for the Navy and the Marine Corps, this plan looks like it would end up eating something like nearly 50% of all U.S. Navy and Marine Corps procurement dollars. Not a likely outcome, and just not a likely outcome. So as usual here, you know, the strategic and force building dream world is going to be undermined over time by the budgetary realities. Frankly, while I'd like to think that Dove and Mackenzie are right, that the Democrats are going to be more likely to put this through if Biden is elected, something like this, I think it would be more something like this than this, because they are going to be constrained by the same fiscal realities going forward as any administration would be. It's not something that's going to happen after the election in any case. If Trump wins, maybe Esper goes, fine, whatever. He can replace him with whoever he likes. But if Biden wins, replacing Esper is sort of a blank being fired out of the gun, because there's not going to be a Trump budget proposal forthcoming to the next Congress, so it's open running for something like this. My own view is that the strategic intention of a Biden presidency would be very similar to what this thing forecasts, probably smaller in numbers because that ain't real. But you know, they're going to be constrained. They're just going to have to be constrained by the fiscal realities on this. We're not going to see this kind of Navy, and we're not going to see cheaper ONS costs going forward, which this plan forecasts.
I want to go to Mackenzie and Gordon. I know you made those trade-offs when you were in the Clinton administration at the Office of Management and Budget. Mackenzie, one of the things that when you were talking about the golden share was that the Air Force would argue, right, that its golden share is actually very small for sort of Air Force air compared with all of the other space and obligations for the joint force that the Air Force has as sort of the understructure of that force. But let me ask you about the shipbuilding discussion that you helped start off. Right, if you can't afford it, then what? right?
Right. And so, well, let me also address one of the issues that came up in all the commentary. So if you blinked, you know, you can miss all these sort of senior leader engagements in the quarantine world we live in. But the Navy Secretary said this week that the CNO is about to put out a new navigation plan. And he also said there's a tri-service maritime strategy coming out. So, you know, a lot of policymakers have been asking for these kinds of, you know, big thinking documents, you know, not just the shipbuilding plan, not just the force structure assessment, but they want to see new operational concepts, war plans, and other vision documents like these. So that's pretty important. And, you know, they're not going to get money without, you know, sort of answering the bigger strategic questions. So including the concept due by the end of the year of all, from all the services. But right. So to your question, you know, how do you afford it? Well, that's exactly what members of Congress, I mean, they are throwing spaghetti on the wall right now because there is support for not necessarily the details of Secretary Esper's plan. And yeah, sure, he probably will leave, but there is support for just moving in that trajectory, you know, in that trend for the Navy to grow it, more ships, smaller ships, partially unmanned, whatever. The details right now are not important to members. It's finding the money. There's talk of everything from, you know, the deterrence fund, which hurts the Army and the Air Force, you know, making that sort of codifying that in appropriations somehow, meaning beyond special authorities, for example, and fencing money, which it is, supporting the Navy's proposal that Esper laid out, where, you know, any expiring funds at the end of the fiscal year are automatically directed into the shipbuilding account, but maybe not just Navy, maybe all DOD expiring funds. You know, there's talk of using the overseas contingency operations account for the Columbia class. Everything's on the table, and members of Congress are taking it seriously, regardless of who's Secretary of Defense in 6 months.
Obviously, all of this is going to depend on what the composition of these committees are. It is something which all of you at one point or another have discussed. Michael, lead us off. You know, a lot of these races are, you know, obviously uncertain, right? Everybody says Susan Collins is going to lose in Maine. Then you see some polls that suggest that she's doing better than people may have anticipated. Tillis was expected to lose. Then you had the Cunningham text issue come up, which changes the dynamic of the election. Lindsey Graham's going to lose. Then you find out, well, Lindsey Graham might not lose. You know, McSally is fighting a very, very dirty campaign, and some would say the same thing about Collins, in order to stay in office. The other side looks at it as Democrats fighting a dirty battle. At the end of the day, what do we know about what the composition of the key committees, right? What's going to happen in terms of the composition, particularly on the Senate side, but as well as on the House side, that could lead to fundamentally different outcomes legislatively? That go beyond just, you know, the Democrats take over, for example.
Right. And, you know, look, obviously we won't know the answers to these questions until Election Day. But there are, for example, in the Senate, you have five Republicans with very tough races. I mean, you've got Joni Ernst in Iowa, Tillis in North Carolina, Dan Sullivan in Alaska, Perdue in Georgia, and Martha McSally in Arizona. So theoretically, there could be up to five openings for the Republicans on that committee. Democrats have two tough races. One, I think, is likely to flip, which is Doug Jones in Alabama. And their other tough race is Gary Peters in Michigan. But Gary Peters' numbers look pretty good right now. But yeah, I think, you know, the real impact is the change at the top of the committee. And, you know, if the Democrats do take control, the gavel would shift from Senator Inhofe to Senator Reid. Now, they've worked very well together on the macro part of the committee. Obviously, they're going to have some policy differences. I think Dove's got some thoughts on that. But, you know, I don't see any major changes in the committee based on the committee makeup, because other Republicans will happily fill those slots that are left open by their colleagues. And, of course, the ratios will change depending on if power flips. Same in the House. There are seven openings on the Republican side on the House Armed Services Committee. But again, that depends on the ratios. I don't believe that there will be seven openings when the election's over, because Charlie Cook predicted yesterday Democrats could pick up as much as 15 seats. So if the Democrats expand their majority, the number of slots available to Republicans will be smaller. Adam Smith will stay as chairman, but Mac Thornberry is retiring. So there will be a new ranking member of the committee to work with Smith. And even though there are three people running, it's really between two people right now. And that's Mike Rogers from Alabama and Mike Turner from Ohio, both very well steeped in defense. So I don't see any major policy issues, except for the fact that Smith will have to deal with more progressives in his caucus fighting for a lower defense spending.
And we're running short on time. So, Dove, you're the one who actually started this all with observing what that difference, a shift between or a shift from Inhofe to Reid will mean. Give us your sense on this question. And then, Gordon, you get the last word and wrap us up. Go ahead.
Oh, very quickly. We were just talking about the Navy, and Gordon is absolutely right. It's going to be hard to find money for the Navy. But if Jack Reid is the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee and works with Adam Smith, well, the two of them are known to be supporters of the Navy, Smith coming from where he comes in Washington and Reid coming from Rhode Island. There may be a greater likelihood. It may not fund everything that Esper's talking about. I think Gordon's right there, but you could see a significant shift of funding from the Army to the Navy. On the other hand, if Inhofe is chairman or remains chairman, well, you know, he doesn't have the same orientation, not too many oceans around Oklahoma. And so there could be a real difference there. One other point, Mike Rogers is well known, as is Mike Turner, but Mike Turner has been chairman of the NATO Parliamentary Conference, the NATO North Atlantic Assembly, as it's called. He's very, very internationalist, and that could make a difference. And finally, self-advertisement. There is a terrific study that just came out, Seth Moulton and Jim Banks, Seth the Republican, Seth the Democrat, Jim the Republican, co-chaired a task force on the future of defense. Amazing at this time of the year and at this time before an election, a bipartisan report, really path-breaking in many ways. And it, I wrote an analysis of it in The Hill. Anybody who's interested, hit The Hill today.
And I should also point out that Seth Moulton was kind enough to join us to discuss a little bit about the cyber elements of the task force report. Both he and Mr. Banks are going to be on over the coming weeks in order to do a much, much deeper dive into the report. And I agree with you, Dove. Absolutely great bipartisan template. Very, very objectively lays out the issue. And the other members who are on that, one of the things that Moulton made clear is, you know, everybody was an equal in this. It was a completely apolitical effort on everybody's part to try to put a bipartisan blueprint together. And I think it was a laudable effort. So I commend people to check out your piece. Gordon, you get the last word. Bring us home.
I got a kind of what sounds like a minor footnote, but maybe the most major impact on what we're talking about on the Hill. And that is that the question of how much money is going to be in the defense top line is not a decision that's going to be made by the authorizers. They'll have some input, but it's not going to be Reid and Smith that set that top line. That's going to be very much at the leadership level. And if the Democrats take the Senate, which is problematic and questionable at this point, but nonetheless possible, the chair of the Appropriations Committee is going to be Patrick Leahy from Vermont. The chair of the Budget Committee is going to be Bernie Sanders from Vermont, right? You're going to have two people who are going to be directly involved with Speaker Pelosi and Majority Leader Schumer in the Senate in the negotiations with whatever White House emerges in terms of what the total defense top line is going to be. And I have to tell you, I see neither Leahy nor Sanders as pushing larger amounts of money into the defense budget as part of those negotiations. So one has to keep, if the Democrats take the Senate, keep your eye on other chairmanships, including appropriations and budget.
I just want to add that Jack Reid happens to be a senior member of appropriations. He'll have a voice in what Gordon was talking about.
That's all the time we've got for guys. Thanks very, very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Hope you guys have a terrific week, a great weekend, and look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.